Hi, I'm Karen Given, executive producer of Only a Game. This is a sports show, sort of, so it might not come as a surprise to learn that we here at Only a Game are relatively competitive people. And this week marks the beginning of a competition of sorts, NPR's year-end digital fundraising campaign. Okay, so it's not a sport exactly, but stick with me. For the next few weeks, we're going to be asking you to go to donate.npr.org/game to make a donation to your local station. By supporting your local station, you'll not only support Only a Game and the other great NPR podcasts you hear, but you'll also support local news, something I think we can all agree is pretty darn important. And if Only a Game listeners raise enough money, we get a trophy. That's right, a trophy. So this is serious, folks. Your local station needs your support, and we need that trophy. We have the perfect spot already picked out for it, right next to our bobblehead collection. Just go to donate.npr.org/game to find your local station and get started. And thanks. This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. Last winter, I was entering the second hour of what I had promised would only be a one-hour interview with TV host and former NFL player Marcellus Wiley when I decided to ask just one more question. I've already run over my time, but I cannot resist. I have to have you tell me the story about Bruce Smith and his shoes.
It's amazing. That story resonates with so many people. I love it. I'm thankful for you even asking. I grow up, I'm a huge fan of John Elway and Eric Dickerson. John Elway, quarterback, Eric Dickerson, running back, because I played that position. Loved them. But Bruce Smith was the man.
Bruce Smith was the hard-hitting defensive end for the Buffalo Bills. He retired from the league in 2003 and was inducted into the Hall of Fame in 2009, his first year of eligibility. He still holds the record for the most sacks in an NFL career, with 200. But in 1994, when Wiley was playing football at Columbia, by this time he was also a defensive end, Bruce Smith was at the top of his game, playing for a Bills team that made four Super Bowl appearances in a row.
And I remember he had some shoes come out, and they were the Air Bruce Smiths. And he had a commercial with Dennis Hopper, and I remember just watching that commercial like, whoa, those shoes are fresh.
I'm holding Bruce Smith's shoe, man. Do you know what Bruce does in these shoes, man? Bad things, man. I mean, bad things.
Okay, so in this commercial, you might remember it, Dennis Hopper plays a deranged fan dressed up as a referee, and he sneaks into the Bills' locker room during a game to touch Bruce Smith's shoes.
You know what Bruce would do if he found me messing with this shoe, man? Bad things, man.
I remember asking my mom, can I get those shoes? She said, how much are those shoes? I said, $79. She's like, psh, boy. In other words, other choice words she had for me, no way I was getting those $79 shoes.
Fast forward to April 1997. Marcellus Wiley was selected in the second round of the NFL draft by none other than the Buffalo Bills.
I was like, Buffalo? Bruce Smith? Whoa. I got drafted to Buffalo with Bruce Smith. He's the best DN ever. And I'm like, man, I fast forward. I'm in the locker room of the Buffalo Bills. I fast forward. My locker is two lockers away from the Bruce Smith. And I'm like, are you kidding me?
For Wiley, it wasn't the name on the locker that was most exciting. It was what was inside.
The wall, the back wall of his locker was a wall of Air Bruce Smith shoes, like dozens of them, just back, 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 back. And I was like, oh my. I just looked at those shoes like, I'm gonna take a pair of his shoes and just put them in my locker. That's what I'm gonna do.
Now look, Wiley had just signed a contract with the Bills. His first year earnings were $500,000. He could have bought himself a pair of Bruce Smith's shoes. Heck, he could have bought himself a wall of Bruce Smith's shoes. But he says it wasn't about that. Stealing Bruce Smith's shoes was his way of proving that he belonged in that locker room, that he belonged on that team.
It's weird. I wanted to be initiated into the Buffalo Bills gang.
So one day, after practice, when Wiley thought he was alone in the locker room...
And I walked by and I just grabbed a pair of his shoes and I put them in my locker bin. Not like full stealing, because if so, I would have took them home and just hid them and all that. I was just like, let me just keep a memento from Bruce Smith. Like, Bruce Smith just gave me his shoes.
Except that he hadn't.
Didn't. Yeah, except he didn't, right?
Details. Wiley was sure he had gotten away clean, but he hadn't.
Someone saw me take those shoes, and it was Thurman Thomas, Big Mouth. Thurman had the best vantage point in the locker room. His locker was like right dead set in the middle, so he could see everything. And I remember one day, shortly thereafter, Thurman's like just joking around. He's like, hey, Bruce, check them shoes out, man. And Bruce's like, what? And he's like, you might be missing a pair. It might be a little light in that locker. And Bruce just looked at his wall of shoes and then just looked at Thurman. And then I was sitting there like just biting my nails in my mind. I'm like, oh, God.
Bruce Smith stared over at Wiley. And Wiley says he just stared back. He didn't know what else to do.
You know what Bruce would do if he found me messing with this shoe, man? Bad things, man.
But Bruce Smith just laughed it off.
He's like, nobody better be messing with my shoes. Whatever. And I was like, woo!
Not long after, the two became friends. Wiley even told Smith the story about stealing his shoes.
He was like, I don't care. But he was like, you could have asked for him. And I was like, yeah, it just wouldn't have felt the same.
Yeah, what did it mean to you that he didn't call you out in that moment? What did that signify to you?
Yeah, it signified that I was a part of the Buffalo Bills. It signified that I was a part of this crew, that I was one of them. Bruce is, I call him Pops. He's my football family dad. Like, I could text Bruce right now before I finish and hit send on the text. He's writing me back. Like, that's my guy. Love him to death.
But here's the thing. Those shoes that were so important to Marcellus Wiley back in 1997 when he was a rookie for the Buffalo Bills, he doesn't even know where they are anymore.
Funny as it is, I probably should have put them in a glass case and protected them. But I think that was the beauty in it, that it didn't have to be just a trophy anymore. It was attainable. It was real.
Marcellus Wiley's book is called Never Shut Up, The Life, Opinions, and Unexpected Adventures of an NFL Outlier. Our full interview with Marcellus Wiley aired last January. Dale Barra was a member of the 1985 New York Yankees. And on April 28th of that year, the Yankees played the Chicago White Sox at Comiskey Park.
After the game, I go into the clubhouse and there's guys cursing. They said to me, go into your dad's office.
Dale Barra's dad was baseball legend and Yankees manager Yogi Barra.
So I walked in there and I said, Dad, what's going on? He said, they got rid of me, Dale.
Yankees owner George Steinbrenner had fired Yogi during the game. Only at games, Gary Wallach has the story.
Dale Barra says it was tough watching his dad get the axe while the entire baseball world watched.
And I wanted to console him, and he had no part of it. He said, I'm going to play golf tomorrow, so don't worry about me. He was going back to New Jersey, back to Montclair, back to see Mom.
But Yogi first needed a ride to the airport. Now, Dale says that standard procedure for fired baseball managers is to say goodbye to the players in the clubhouse and then take a lonely cab ride to the airport for a lonely flight home. But not Yogi. He was the first to board the team bus.
And he sat in the same manager's seat that he would have sat in had he not been fired.
Which was right up front near the driver.
All the players are getting on the bus and they're passing my dad, sitting in the manager's seat.
Dale says some players tapped Yogi on the hand or shoulder or offered words of encouragement as they went to their seats. The Yankees' next series was in Texas against the Rangers. But before the driver went to the terminal for the Yankees' charter, he stopped the bus at the entrance for United Airlines departures.
Dad stands up from his manager's seat, turns around and says, "You guys are a great team. You guys go out and play. You guys go out and win. Go out and play for Billy Martin, your next manager, exactly the way you did for me. Billy's a great manager. You guys are good.
And then Yogi did something that triggered a response he had seen from fans so many times during his playing days on the vaunted Yankees of the 40s, 50s, and 60s. Only, he didn't need to belt a clutch home run or throw a runner out at second. It was a much simpler act.
He walked off the bus, got his bags from underneath, and walked toward United Airlines, turned around and waved at the bus. The whole bus stood up and gave him a standing ovation, every player on the bus.
Yogi Berra never again managed a Major League Baseball team.
That's Only a Game's Gary Wallach. A little less than 100 years ago, the most popular barnstorming baseball team in the nation was called the House of David.
If you look at the biggest crowd attendance during the 1920s and early 1930s, it was the House of David versus this team, House of David versus this team, House of David versus this team.
That's Chris Siriano. He's the founder and director of the House of David Baseball Museum in Michigan.
So they were a huge draw.
The House of David was a huge draw because they were so good. As they traveled the U.S. and Canada and Mexico and Cuba, they would poach the best players they could find. They'd tell them,
hey, come play with the House of David. We'll pay you three times what your local team is paying you, and you can travel the world with us. And all you got to do is sign here, start growing your whiskers, and don't shave till the end of the year.
And that brings us to the second reason for the House of David's popularity. They definitely stood out in a crowd, with hair halfway down their backs and beards longer than Santa Claus. Because members of the House of David didn't drink, didn't smoke, didn't have sex, and
part of their belief was that they could never shave or cut their hair. And they quoted a scripture in Leviticus for that.
And there was a third component of the House of David's appeal. The team had access to a lot of money. Apparently, running a cult has always been a big business opportunity.
Well, by 1923, I think they had $32 million in the bank.
And so the House of David baseball team could pretty much afford to sign anyone they wanted. Satchel Paige, the best pitcher the Negro Leagues had ever seen, he played for the team. Babe Diedrichsen, the darling of the 1932 Olympics, and Jackie Mitchell, the woman who struck out Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig in the same game, they barnstormed with the House of David. And then there was Babe Ruth.
I have footage of Babe Ruth putting his fake whiskers on and getting up and cracking like a three-base hit. It was just always publicity, how to get the biggest crowd.
To be clear, Babe Ruth only played for the House of David once or twice. He was nothing close to a regular. But there was one man who played for the House of David for quite a long time, and his name had been almost as big as the Babe's back in his day.
They got Grover Cleveland Alexander, who had been a Hall of Fame pitcher, to manage and pitch for the team from 31 to 35.
Grover Cleveland Alexander's first year with the Phillies has been called, quote, arguably the greatest season by a rookie pitcher in the 20th century. But that was 1911, and by 1931, he had been through a lot.
You know, he played for the Philly team, and then he played for the St. Louis Cardinals for quite a long time, and then won the World Series for them in 26, and then went on to keep playing. But then his drinking got in the way, and he got fired from Major League Baseball. He got a real bad reputation for being a drunk.
If Grover Cleveland Alexander couldn't get sober to play in the majors, he certainly wasn't going to get sober to play for the teetotaling House of David.
They paid his wife the same salary that they paid him to keep him sober through the fourth inning stretch, because they had to assure the competitor that he was going to be there because he was such a big draw. He was so good, he could totally throw strikes intoxicated, and they let him wear his house slippers so he could feel the pitcher's mound underneath his feet because he couldn't quite see it so good when he was drunk.
Because while members of the House of David couldn't drink, couldn't smoke, couldn't have sex or shave or cut their hair, the team's ringers didn't have to follow those rules.
They pretty much could do anything they want. Just make sure you show up and play your game and don't shave till the end of the year.
Except Grover Cleveland Alexander couldn't even do that.
He had a phobia for facial hair, so they didn't make him grow his whiskers. So he's the only clean-shaven House of David player ever.
We first told the story of the House of David and its association with Satchel Paige and the Negro Leagues back in April. It's the weekend after Thanksgiving, which can only mean one thing. Thanksgiving leftovers, brand new stories made from the leftovers of previous interviews. After the break, a former inmate tries to use an iPhone, a cave diver travels to the end of the world, and the real-life friendship between an NFL kicker and the player known as Beast Mode, coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
Thanksgiving can be full of turkey disasters.
It was just pasty and white, and you know, it had this gross cloth over the top of it.
We'll talk about how to avoid that and keep Thanksgiving simple and edible. Plus, a chat with celebrity chef Samin Nosrat. Next time on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
I'm Karen Given. Valentino Dixon spent 27 years of his life in maximum security facilities for a murder he did not commit. He was released from prison in September of 2018, thanks in part to his illustrations of golf courses. It's a crazy story. You should go to our website and listen to the original. Here's Only a Game's Gary Wallach.
I caught up with Valentino Dixon about a month after his release. He was a happy man, ecstatic even.
Only issue I have is this iPhone that my daughter bought me, and I want to take this thing and smash it up against the wall some days because it's so difficult and it's giving me a hard time. You know, it's really driving me nuts. Let me tell you something that's so crazy. I was in New York City, right? I was in a hotel. I needed to get an Uber. So I didn't know how to download no Uber app on my phone. I stopped this guy in a hotel. Seemed like a decent guy to stop. I said, hey, guy, could you do me a favor? He says, what? I says, I need you to download this Uber app on my phone so I can get an Uber ride from the hotel. Excuse my language. He says, you kidding me? I said, yeah, I'm serious. I said, listen, man, I just got out of jail for 27 years for something I didn't do, and I don't know how to download an app on my phone or to get the Uber, how to use the Uber. So he says, guy, what are you talking about 27 years? You don't even look 27. You know, they always tell me I look young. So I said, Google Valentino Dixon.
So Valentino hadn't mastered the iPhone, but he knew about Google.
So he Googles my name, and he says, oh, my God, you did time in jail. You serious? He says, this is you, isn't it? And I said, yeah, I told you. He says, you got a smile on your face? He said, how is that even possible? He said, I'll never smile for the rest of my life if I did 27 years in jail for something I didn't do. I says, man, I'm not even mad. That's not who I am. He says, guy, listen, man, you got me shaking right now. He says, I'll do anything you want me to do. Come on, let's do it. And he hooked it up for me, and he says, dude, you changed my life, man. You made me think about things a whole totally different.
Valentino Dixon got his Uber ride. He got to where he was meant to be. He's been helping people think differently about things ever since.
That's Only a Game's Gary Wallach. Since his release, Valentino Dixon played golf for the first time, and in April, he attended the Masters, where he met Jack Nicklaus and Tiger Woods. Dixon's art is exhibiting around the country. And just for good measure, he started his own foundation for prison and sentencing reform. One of Only a Game's most popular stories of 2019 was Jill Heinerth's tale of cave diving inside an iceberg in Antarctica. But there was a part of that interview we left out of that original airing, and it has to do with how Heinerth and her colleagues got to that iceberg. Jill tells that story now in her own words.
The ship's name was the Braveheart. Great, great little vessel. It was a former Japanese fishing and research vessel, only, you know, 118 feet long, which is pretty small, and a crew of 18 people. It wasn't ice strengthened, but it was a good little ship. To go to Antarctica from New Zealand is a 12-day sea crossing across the craziest ocean conditions. So you're constantly in horrendous seas up to 60 feet high. And I asked some of the other people involved, I said, well, you know, all the other ships I see in Antarctica, the other four in this part of the Southern Ocean, were all, you know, 300 feet ice-strengthened hull, you know, built in Russia, big, strong vessels. And I was told, well, at 118 feet, you have a chance to kind of bounce in between the waves as opposed to breaking in half. So that was not a lot of comfort for that journey down. When we loaded the boat in New Zealand, I remember I carried a bottle of beer from Canada, and it was called Le Fin du Monde, which means the end of the world. I remember jumping from the dock onto the Braveheart, and the captain, he was very, you know, sturdy-looking New Zealander with big meat hooks for hands, and he wore this pilled Argyle shirt and a little vest, but he had this stern look on his face, and when I jumped aboard, he was rather disgusted that he was going to have to travel with a woman to Antarctica, because women were bad luck on boats. And sure enough, as I jumped on board from the dock to the Braveheart, I slipped and smashed my bottle of the end of the world. So that was my christening of the Braveheart.
That's Jill Heinerth in her own words. Heinerth and her colleagues made it to that iceberg, but they almost didn't make it back. Really, you should go listen to Matthew Stock's original story. It aired back in September. Back in May, we told the story of the brothers who created the hit cartoon series Game of Zones, a mashup of the NBA and Game of Thrones.
Oh, how quickly they forget. 9 years I ruled the East. From 3-1 down, I slayed the warriors.
Well, for our next Thanksgiving leftover, we've got a mashup of our own. Here's Only a Game's Martin Kessler.
Before Adam and Craig Malamut started drawing cartoon versions of LeBron James wearing flowing purple and gold robes and a crown, the brothers worked on a different cartoon sports series.
Hey, Dwayne.
What's up, LeBrownie?
I'm kind of craving something right now.
You craving? What are you craving?
I'm kind of craving a championship. I really want one.
Called Sports Friends. Here's Adam, followed by his brother, Craig.
The series was basically just athletes talking to each other, but in, like, vulnerable ways that, like, I think made a lot of people uncomfortable.
It's kind of like just an intensely fictionalized version of sports, I would say.
You know what's really cool, actually, is Chris.
Yes.
Yeah. He's, like, when I first got here, I was like, I don't know about this guy.
Yeah, me too.
But then, like, just playing with him and dunking with him and, like, experiencing basketball with him, like, I really like him on and off the court.
He's really cool. Like, he's a great
now,
guy.
It just so happens that one of the athletes Adam and Craig parodied on Sports Friends was also featured on Only a Game this past year.
Yeah, my name is Steven Hauschka. I go by Steve with my friends and everything. I guess I'm Steven in the football world. Sometimes it's spelled with a PH. That's my given name. And then I also get spelled with a V.
You may remember Steven Hauschka's story. In brief, he was an aspiring Division III soccer player at Middlebury College who ended up kicking for the football team at NC State, where he was so happy to make the team that he didn't complain when his name was misspelled on the roster. Steven Hauschka ended up on the Seattle Seahawks from 2011 to 2016, a stretch when the Seahawks had a number of superstars, including Marshawn Lynch, a running back known as Beast Mode.
Lynch not going to get anything. Well, maybe second effort. He comes out the back of it, and he's in. Touchdown!
Lynch is famous for the creative ways he avoided questions from reporters.
How important was it to keep the ball on the ground and run out the clock, especially in the fourth quarter when you know this team is so good in the fourth quarter?
Yeah.
How does your back feel, Marshawn?
Yeah.
You got those heating pads in your cleats?
I got a foundation dinner at the Edgewater on December 14th.
And in 2013, a cartoon version of Marshawn Lynch, a.k.a. Beast Mode, appeared in an episode of Sports Friends with a cartoon version of Steven, sometimes with a PH, sometimes with a V, Hauschka.
I don't know if we met, by the way. I'm Steve.
Hey, I'm Marshawn. Hey. Marshawn, nice to meet you.
Yeah, nice to meet you. So Marshawn Lynch meets Stephen Hauschka, the kicker, for the first time during a game. Like, they never met. And he's like, they meet each other at the water cooler, and he's like, hey. He's like, so your offense?
Yeah. I'm with the offense.
Cool.
I'm a running back. I'm the starting running back. So I'm the guy you've seen probably scoring a bunch of touchdowns.
Cool, yeah.
Beast mode.
Yeah, okay, you're the beast mode guy. Okay, great, yeah.
Beast mode
I've heard about
me.
Oh, yeah, that was awesome.
That's Alex Buggy, close friend and former college teammate of the real-life Stephen Hauschka. When I spoke to Alex for our story about Stephen's career, I couldn't help asking about the cartoon. And he had this to say about the real relationship between Marshawn and Stephen.
You know, Marshawn is kind of a quiet guy with the media, but him and Marshawn get along really well. And Marshawn's family is pretty, pretty cool. We hung out with his uncles and stuff after some of the games. So, yeah, it was kind of a unique bond. And I think Marshawn was one of Steve's biggest fans actually on that team.
So it turns out Stephen Hauschka and Marshawn Lynch really were sports friends.
Yeah,
cool.
Great.
I'll see you around.
Yeah, I'll see you around.
Cool. Awesome.
Take it easy.
You too.
Go Seahawks.
Yeah, woo, go Seahawks. Cool, man.
That story was from Only a Game's Martin Kessler. We'll have a link to that cartoon and other episodes of Sports Friends at onlyagame.org.
My name is Brenda Tracy. I'm here from Portland, Oregon today. I'm a Oregon? Anybody? Oh, hey, okay, hi.
This is a recording from the 2018 National Character and Leadership Symposium at the U.S. Air Force Academy. And Brenda Tracy is doing something she does quite often, standing in front of a group of strangers and telling them about the worst day of her life.
I kind of forget where I am sometimes. Half the time, I don't even know what time zone I'm in.
Brenda Tracy is a rape survivor and an advocate. Her goal is to get men involved in the fight against sexual violence. So she travels, often 40 weeks a year, speaking in locker rooms and team rooms and university lecture halls. Most of the time, Brenda is standing in front of athletes, almost always men, at colleges like Michigan, Nebraska, Arkansas, Stanford. And she almost always starts with a question.
Who here is under the age of 25? And yeah, raise your hand.
And then I tell them that you could be my child because my sons are 24 and 25.
I want you to think about that because, I mean, seriously, as I share my story today, how would you feel if you were? What if you were my son or my daughter and you were sitting on that side and it was your mom up here talking about this story and what she went through? So.
And then do you tell them the story of your rape?
Yes. We start off with that. It's hard for everybody in the room. And I usually cry. Well, I always cry. But yeah, I go into very graphic detail about it. I actually reopen that wound and I walk them through it.
We're not going to go into detail today, but here's the short version. In 1998, Brenda Tracy was a single mother of two young boys. She was visiting an apartment near the campus of Oregon State University. She was given a drink. She believes it was drugged. And over the next 6 hours, she was sexually assaulted by four men. Two of them played football for Oregon State. Brenda reported the rape the next day. She told the police, she told the school. But she says the prosecutor told her that she didn't have a case. So she dropped the charges. And for the next 16 years...
Every day, I literally just wanted to die. I felt that those men had ruined me. Who would ever love me? Who would ever respect me? How could I ever talk about this to anyone? How could I ever be in a relationship? How could my children ever respect me? What if my sons, when they were your age, what were they going to do when they found out about their mom? How could they ever respect me, not be ashamed of me, not be embarrassed of me?
I hid it from them for a long time. My older boy was 17 before I told him. We kind of came to a space where I knew I was either going to be visiting my son in prison or my son was going to be dead. So in that moment, I felt like, okay, I need to tell him who I am and why I am the way that I am, because we had a very contentious relationship while he was growing up. So I remember we sat in the car and I cried and I told him what happened to me. And I said, please don't be mad at me. Please don't be ashamed of me. I'm so sorry. And he kind of looked at me and he's like, Mom, why would I be ashamed of you? You did nothing wrong. And that really surprised me. I was not expecting that response from him. But then the other thing that he said to me that broke my heart was he said, so you mean all these years it wasn't my fault? And what he meant by that was for those 16 years as I was raising him, as I was dealing with depression, couldn't get out of bed, angry, irritated, you know, he was blaming himself that he had done something wrong all those years. And so that moment for us was a transformational moment. He looked at me in a different way. He looked at me as a mom who was just doing the best that she could to survive her trauma. And he is my biggest fan. Both my boys are. People don't always realize that it's not just about the survivor. It's not just the victim that has survived, but it's the families too. You know, my sons are survivors.
Neither of Brenda's sons has seen her speak. She says she doesn't want them to have to hear the details, but they know the work their mom does, traveling the country, talking to athletes about putting an end to sexual violence. It's important.
It's amazing for them to see the love from the teams that I get, and you know, the players that support me.
And there's one more aspect of all of this that Brenda Tracy didn't expect. When those athletes reach out to thank her for sharing her story, they often tell her something else. Many of them say that after hearing her speak, they went home and called their moms. Have you subscribed to the Only a Game podcast yet? It's the best way to make sure you never miss a second of our show. Find us wherever you get your podcasts. And thanks. We'll be right back with more Thanksgiving leftovers. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR. Only a Game is produced in Boston with help from listeners like you. Why not make a donation today? Just go to donate.npr.org/game to find your local station. And thanks. I'm Karen Given. In a lot of ways, this next story begins with this song.
Honky, honky, the Christmas goose got so fat that he was no use till he learned how to blow his nose, honk the way a goose nose blows.
In the fall of 1965, a producer for the CBC, that's the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, went to a Toronto Maple Leafs practice to look for an NHL player willing to sing on a Christmas album for kids. He found goalie Johnny Bower.
Santa sure was worried for their children on his list.
And just to give you an idea of how much of a big deal Bower was, he won three consecutive Stanley Cups with the Leafs between 62 and 64, and another in 67 for good measure. The Canadian government put his photo on a stamp in 2004. So anyway, Johnny Bower recorded Honky the Christmas Goose in November of 1965 with his son and some neighborhood kids singing along.
Oh, honky, honky the Christmas.
And as soon as the song was released, it started climbing the Toronto music charts.
Now he rides in the Christmas sleigh, he honks his horn to tell the world the Santa Claus is on his way.
Right around this same time, Brian McFarlane was just a year into his 28-year stint with Canada's most popular weekly program.
Again, from coast to coast, it's Hockey Night in Canada.
As Honky the Christmas Goose climbed the Toronto music charts, Brian had an idea, and it involved one of his favorite players, a forward nicknamed the Entertainer.
Eddie Shack was a rambunctious, colorful player who dashed all over the ice and bumped into his opponents, and he bumped into his own players and his goaltender.
I tried to find some highlights from Eddie Shack's career, but when I searched online, all I could find were fights, dozens and dozens of them.
Eddie Shack, number 23, being restrained.
Shack still has the headlock on Rayon. That was a savage swing by Pilot at Shack's head.
That winter, Eddie Shack was on his way to a 26-goal season, and that's when Brian approached Eddie with his big idea.
I said, Eddie, I'd like to write a song about you, and he's like, I don't care what you do.
At the time, Brian and Eddie were friends, but because of this moment, this seemingly inconsequential moment, the pair's relationship would become strained, and it would stay that way for decades. But back to our story.
So I wrote Clear the Track, here comes Shaq, he knocks him down, he gives him a whack, he can score goals, he's found the knack, Eddie Shaq. I'm not a musician, know nothing about music, but my brother-in-law had a doctorate in music, so he dashed off the song, I wrote the words, we hired a group, looked like the Beatles, but they weren't nearly as talented.
They were called The Secrets. Brian approached them after a show at the Toronto Pressman's Club and offered to pay them $500 to record the song he wrote for his friend Eddie Shack.
The one we booked RCA Victor Studios to do the recording, and my brother-in-law heard them in the studio. He came over and he said, Brian, they're not very good. I said, well, Bill, how would I know? I'm not a musician, but they're good enough, maybe.
Clear the track, here comes Shack.
Never mind the band's talent, or lack thereof, Brian had the perfect plan to debut his new song. See, he was the person responsible for producing the vignettes that would air on national television during the first intermission on Hockey Night in Canada. And he figured, why not feature Clear the Track, Here Comes Shaq during the next Maple Leafs broadcast?
I suggested we'd have the musicians on the ice at Maple Leaf Gardens. I was going to put them all in number 23 sweaters, Shaq's number, and have them playing and singing on the ice. But that got vetoed down. My boss said to me, we'll just play some film of Eddie Shaq skating back and forth and bumping into people and play the song in the background.
It's great to see him on right wing, or is it the left wing he plays? Well, maybe it's both at the same time.
Clear the Track, Here Comes Shaq debuted in February 1966, and it was an instant hit, quickly climbing to number one on Toronto's music charts and staying there for 2 weeks.
Well, I was astonished to see it climb the charts and become number one ahead of the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. I always thought the other side, Warming the Bench, was just as good.
I'm warming the bench, I'm warming the bench, I spent half my life just warming the bench.
But when you do a record, I found out the B side never gets played, it's always the A side.
Brian was thrilled with his song's success. Eddie was not.
And he harassed me for the next 30 years saying, you never paid me any royalties. And I said, Eddie, you don't get any. You gave me permission to write the song, and you're not featured on the song. Mr. Shaq even went to my boss one day and tried to get me dismissed from my job because I wouldn't pay him. But he was quite willing to ask me for free records to give away to his friends.
Now, did he ever have as good a season as he had that year?
No, he after that 26-goal season, he had other 20-goal seasons. Eddie couldn't seem to hold his place in the NHL with one team for very long. I know in Boston, when he played there, he was selling hats as an avocation in the summer months. He was working for some hat company, and he criticized the team owner in Boston for wearing the, well, excuse the word, but the crappiest hats in the world. And, of course, he was traded to L.A. about 6 weeks later, so I don't think the owner liked the comments he made about the hats he was wearing.
I haven't been able to independently confirm that Eddie Shaq tried to get Brian McFarlane fired, but this part seems to be verifiably true. Eddie was traded to L.A. after disparaging the Bruins owner's hats. But back to Brian McFarlane and those royalties.
He never did get any payment, and frankly, neither did I. It was 30 years went by, and I said, I wonder why I never got any royalties. So I called some music union and asked, and they said, well, it's far too late for that, Mr. McFarlane. Would you take $1,000? I said, I absolutely would.
As for the friendship between Brian McFarlane and Eddie Shaq?
We both mellowed in time, and We're back on speaking terms now.
We left multiple messages for Eddie Shack, trying to get his perspective on this story. We never heard back. But just last week, Eddie appeared on a Canadian podcast called Writer's Block to promote his new book.
Everybody's favorite Toronto Maple Leaf, the great, the colorful Eddie Shack joining us.
And before the hosts could even finish introducing him and his co-author, Eddie launched into the song.
He scores goals, he's got the knack. Eddie Shack.
Eddie Shack is quite clearly still proud to have been the subject of a song that spent a couple of weeks at Toronto's number one.
But who beat me out was Nancy Sinatra.
Nancy Sinatra?
Yeah, well,
these boots? Yeah. These boots? Well, that's not a... And that's not a bad song.
When Eddie was at number one, the Beach Boys were at number six. I mean, what world are we living in?
I remember it vividly. It was way better than the Johnny Bauer song, I got to say. Like, yes. If I had to choose between Clear the Track
and when we'd get together, Johnny, honky, honky, the Christmas goose.
It all turned out all right for Eddie Shack and his old friend, Brian McFarlane. But what about the secrets? The band Brian paid to record the song? Well, it turns out that they were in no way proud of their number one hit.
So they changed their name to The Quiet Jungle, and they grew long beards, and they wore turtleneck sweaters, and they didn't want any association with Eddie Shack and the song. And it's the only song they'll ever be known for.
Brian McFarlane is a former commentator for Hockey Night in Canada. He's written 93 books on hockey. And believe it or not, there is one more story Brian told us when I interviewed him last winter. Keep listening for that piece on an upcoming episode of Only a Game. Journalism is a public service, and back in October, we brought you the very important story behind Keith Comstock's 1989 minor league baseball card. You know, the one where he struck a pose that would go down in baseball card history?
I just said, I'm going to take it to the nuts. And then, you know, to make a face like what that ball of hitting you in that area and how much it would hurt.
Keith Comstock was a guy rebelling against baseball tradition. Only a Game's Martin Kessler has the story of what happened next.
Keith Comstock last pitched in 1991. He was in his mid-30s. Keith stuck around the game. He started working as a minor league pitching coach. And in 1998, Keith Comstock, the guy who posed with a baseball to his nuts, became a manager.
I did get to manage 4 years in the minor leagues, and I loved it. I loved it when the game was going on. I didn't like it before the game or after the game because too many times those players would get in trouble and I'd have to go address the trouble.
As Keith suggests, managing a low-level minor league club involves a lot more than setting the lineup and pitching rotation. You've got to make sure a lot of other things run smoothly too, like the photo shoots for the baseball cards. You might not be surprised to hear that Keith's players came to him with some creative ideas.
Anytime they came up to me, if they wanted to do a picture like with their catcher's gear on with a ball to the groin area, knock yourself out. Go for it. Blocking a ball, take a ball to your throat, go for it. One guy wanted to stick the ball in his mask. Knock yourself out. That's a beautiful guard.
But Keith wasn't going to let just any idea through. See, Keith Comstock had a code.
As long as it wasn't a photo that disrespected the game, I'm all for it. If it was anything that disrespected the game, then I was absolutely against it.
So what did you say no to? Any photos that
I did not. A guy wanted to take a picture arguing with an umpire. I didn't want to do that.
Mm.
Some guy wanting to take a picture with a girl in there. No. That ain't going to happen.
Keith is now the rehab pitching coordinator for the Texas Rangers, and he takes it upon himself to keep players safe from a particular injury with which he's closely associated.
Today's generation of pitchers just don't like to wear cups. It doesn't feel comfortable. And trust me, getting in there in that area will not feel comfortable. So get used to wearing a cup. I know with the Rangers, we tell our pitchers, if you don't wear a cup, we'll find out because we'll take our fungos around those fields and we'll pop you one. If you're not wearing a cup, we're going to find out. That's one of my favorite things to do in spring training.
That story was from Only a Game's Martin Kessler. The 1975 World Series between the Cincinnati Reds and the Boston Red Sox was a memorable one.
Hey, that was a great series.
That's Pete Rose, and he has good reason to feel that way, because his 10 hits and aggressive base running were crucial to the outcome, as was his cockiness. Only a Game's Gary Wallach has the story.
Back in July, I talked with Pete Rose about his USO tour of Vietnam with Joe DiMaggio. Rose was self-deprecating and humble. Now, those are not the qualities for which Rose, infamous for his lifetime ban from baseball for gambling on Major League games, is best known. But toward the end of our interview, Rose's hubris emerged in all of its unfettered glory. It happened when I told him that the 1975 World Series broke my 12-year-old Red Sox-loving heart.
Let me tell you one story about that series. Okay.
How could I say no to Pete Rose?
We're playing Game 7, and Bill Lee's ahead 3-0.
Kurt Gowdy had the call.
And here we go with Pete Rose at the top of the order in the sixth inning.
Just for a little historical context, the Red Sox hadn't won a World Series since 1918. Anticipation among Red Sox fans that they'd finally win it all at Fenway Park was ridiculously high. And now they were up 3-0 in the top of the sixth with their best starter on the mound.
There's a base hit by Rose in the right field.
Then Lee got Joe Morgan to fly to right.
I'm on first base, there's one out.
Reds catcher Johnny Bench was the next batter up. I hoped Bill Lee could get him to ground into a double play.
There's a bounding ball to short. They've got one. They turn it over. Wild throw by Doyle into the dugout.
Rose slid hard into Red Sox second baseman Denny Doyle.
I knocked Denny Doyle on his butt, and he threw the ball into the dugout. Okay? No double play, because I broke up a double play.
Rose was out, but Bench advanced to second on the throwing error. Reds cleanup hitter Tony Perez came to the plate with two out and one on. Lee's first pitch, a fastball, missed outside.
The next pitch, Bill Lee threw an Ephus pitch.
The Ephus pitch was a blooper thrown high into the air to fool the batter into thinking there's no chance the ball could drop in for a strike. That worked for Bill Lee, some of the time.
There's his blooper pitch. There it is. A high drive. He's waiting for that one. That one is gone over everything. Perez timed that blooper pitch and slammed it over the screen out in the Lansdowne Street. And now we have another one-run ball game in this World Series.
And because I broke that double play up, now it's 3-2 and all the momentum's on our side.
Failure to make the double play has been costly to the Red Sox.
You had us down 3-0 in Game 7. But because of a hard slide in the second, the whole momentum of that game turned around, and then we went on to win the game.
And Cincinnati has won the World Championship, beating the Boston Red Sox 4-3.
When I confided to Pete Rose that he and Cincinnati's Big Red Machine had broken my tender young heart in 1975, I was hoping for a little bit of consolation or sympathy, or the kind of mature insight Rose had shown when he shared poignant stories about the GIs he and Joe DiMaggio met in Vietnam hospitals and war zones. But not this time, and certainly not regarding the 1975 World Series, which many, including Pete Rose, consider the greatest of all time.
You know why that was the best ever?
Why?
Because I was MVP in that series.
Thanks, Pete.
That's Only a Game's Gary Wallach. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach, with help from Jonathan Chang. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is me. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.